You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Millwrights Local 1529 and the International Association of Machinists Local 778. Millwrights Local 1529 has supported labor and working class families for over 100 years. And the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local Lodge 778 in Kansas City, Missouri, represents thousands of working class people in and around the metro. Our members work in a variety of industries, including automotive, manufacturing, freight, and logistics and public works. We proudly support the Heartland Labor Forum as it continues to educate our friends and neighbors about the issues affecting Missouri's working class families. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. Tonight on the show, you hear a lot of critiques of the economic system that we live in on this show. But this week, we're going to talk about alternatives with Ted Howard, co-author of The Making of a Democratic Economy. How do we get to economic justice? Then, what does the past tell us about the present? We'll talk about the popular new movie, Harriet. Is it an accurate story? We'll find out from historian Albert Lowe. In the news, NLRB lets McDonald's off the hook. And in South Korea, labor law violators go to jail. Wow. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. And he'll do a review of 2019 for labor. Now for the news.
On the news from our side, December 26th, 2019. On December 12th, the National Labor Relations Board handed down a decision that gives fast food behemoth McDonald's good reason to celebrate the holidays. The gift from Trump's NLRB lets them off the hook for bad labor practices for their franchisees. There are 14,000 McDonald's restaurants, most of which are franchises. So this decision means that 800,000 workers at McDonald's franchise restaurants have no right to bring labor charges against or negotiate with McDonald's, only with the franchisee where they work. Obviously, if workers are to gain any bargaining power, they need to be able to negotiate with the Big Mac itself. Michael Hilzik reported in the Los Angeles Times that the NLRB decision only affects a handful of workers who brought unfair labor practice charges in 2014. Yes, it took that long for the NLRB to decide. Three workers were fired and 17 suspended for their participation in the Fight for 15 and a union. During the Obama administration, the NLRB ruled that McDonald's was a joint employer with its franchisees, which would have made the company liable for the labor law violations of the franchise owners. But the Trump NLRB settled a series of cases against both franchises and McDonald's with a small settlement because the franchisees are considered a small business. When that was appealed to the national level, the three Trump appointees outvoted the one remaining Obama appointee and confirmed the new interpretation that McDonald's is not a joint employer. This decision further expands the growing trend to sever any legal responsibility of large corporations from the workers whose toil makes them rich.
Here's a happier story that comes to us from Seoul, South Korea, via PAI, the Union News Service. The Seoul Central District Court convicted and sentenced Samsung Electronics chairman of the board, Lee Sang-hoon, the tech company's number two executive, to 18 months in prison on December 17th for actively sabotaging labor union activities in violation of South Korea's labor laws. Samsung Vice President Kang Kun-hoon was given the same prison sentence for his involvement. Several dozen other current and former employees at various Samsung locations were also convicted for their mistreatment of unions and workers. South Korea's Trade Union and Labor Relations Adjustment Act of 1997 defined unfair labor practices in a very similar way to U.S. law. Employers can't discriminate against workers for union activity, set up company unions, or prohibit workers from organizing, but there's one big difference, the penalties. In South Korea, a boss found guilty of a ULP shall be punished by imprisonment for up to 2 years or by a fine of $17,000 in U.S. dollars. Despite such heavy penalties, evidently bad bosses never learn. Of course, in the U.S., bad bosses only get a proverbial slap on the wrist. Also in the U.S., any fines are levied on corporations, not individual bosses. In South Korea, Samsung executives were found guilty of various union busting activities, including threats to wages and withdrawing businesses from subcontractors who were union-friendly. Legal action was triggered by a leak of internal company documents containing union busting guidelines issued to management by Samsung executives. U.S. corporations do that all the time. Samsung has been anti-union for years. Only a handful of union bargaining units exist within the tech conglomerate 60-some departments. But last month, workers at Samsung Electronics formed their first recognized trade union under the Federation of Korean Trade Unions, well known for its militant rank-and-file stances. Meanwhile, Samsung heir Lee Ye-hung is facing a retrial on bribery charges. Maybe corruption and union busting are evil results of the same corporate greed.
Vice reports that e-scooter workers in San Francisco at the Ford-owned startup Spin have joined a union. About 40 Spin workers have signed up with Teamsters Local 665. Union spokesperson Kara Dinez says, "We are confident this is the first in the nation for e-scooter workers. Spin didn't put up any resistance. They were very supportive of workers, the majority of whom signed up as union members during card check. Spin operates e-scooters in 70 different cities and college campuses. Unlike many app-based companies, Spin hires its workers as employees rather than contracted workers. Thus, they have the right to organize and join unions. And Spin in San Francisco and Los Angeles has offered them paid time off, health care, and dental insurance, benefits typically denied to contractors. Independent contractors, including Lyft and Uber drivers, also do not have the right to unionize. Perhaps it's a trend. Vice says e-scooter companies Bird and Lime have also begun hiring some workers as employees. A Spin spokesperson said their policy is to hire employees and hire locally rather than independent contractors and staffing agencies. She said, "We believe investing in everyone from our headquarters to our warehouses leads to a safer, more reliable service." California recently passed a law that could reclassify many of the state's roughly 200,000 gig workers as employees. The law goes into effect in January. Tonight's news has been read by Heather Schlossman, Tom Gebkin, and myself, Chris Mann.
Come join our woeful soul.
this is Judy Ansel, and that was the Seattle Labor Chorus. Today, there's no shortage of people who are critical of capitalism. Until recently, even mentioning the word capitalism, let alone socialism, got you branded as a commie or a pinko. So people stopped naming the system. They let people believe the dominant propaganda that system-wise, we were at the end of history. We'd reached the best of all possible worlds, especially after the collapse of the Soviet Union and China's embrace of iconic state capitalism. It was decided. Capitalism had won. There was no alternative. Last week on the show, we talked about the extreme form of free market capitalism called neoliberalism. This week, we're showing that there is an alternative growing up inside the cracks in capitalism. But it's not exactly old-style socialism, let alone communism. We'll find out what it is as we talk to Ted Howard, who has just written a book with Marjorie Kelly called The Making of a Democratic Economy, Building Prosperity for the Many, Not Just the Few. Ted is co-founder and president of the Democracy Collaborative, which works to carry out a vision of a new economic system where shared ownership and control creates more equitable and inclusive outcomes, fosters ecological sustainability, and promotes flourishing democratic and community life. Ted's been called a visionary, and as someone who has bemoaned the shortage of visionaries and the excess of critics, I welcome you, Ted, to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Wonderful to be here with you, Judy. Thank you very much for the kind introduction.
You know, I think the best way to start is with something concrete rather than a bunch of abstract theory. So tell us the story of one of the institutions of the new democratic economy that most grabs your imagination of what's possible.
Well, one that is particularly close to my heart because I had the opportunity to work on it a bit is taking place in Cleveland, Ohio, where I live. And as you know, Cleveland is an older industrial Rust Belt city that used to be one of America's manufacturing powerhouses and indeed one of the wealthiest cities in America. But because of the process of deindustrialization and jobs moving offshore and changes in industry, Cleveland's now one of the three poorest cities in America. And about 10 years ago, a group of us in Cleveland, including leaders of large hospitals and universities and the city government and my organization, the Democracy Collaborative and others, said, let's try a new approach to creating decent work and jobs in our city based on new principles. And what resulted was something that's thriving now called the Evergreen Cooperatives. These are a network, an integrated network of for-profit companies, all of which are owned by the people who work in them, the several hundred people, that provide goods and services to the large hospitals and universities and so forth. And they're located in some of the most poor and really disinvested neighborhoods in the entire city, and are hiring people from the neighborhoods and making them productive and putting them into work. And when their companies are loyal to Cleveland, they're not going to pick up and leave like so many other corporations. And rather than being owned by absentee investors, they're literally owned by the people who work in them. So there's a democratic component at the workplace. There's profit sharing. The companies are green. And this kind of points in my mind to, even though it's just, say, 300 people at this point in these several companies, it points to a new way of organizing business and labor and ownership. And these are all hallmarks of what we call democratic economy.
And you call that the Cleveland model, is that right?
Well, it's been called that in a lot of the press. And I think it's interesting that it's been branded the Cleveland model.
Uh-huh.
Because it really is a new approach, and indeed about two dozen cities around the country and cities even in the United Kingdom are building on what we've been able to accomplish and are creating their own models of a sort of localized, more democratic economy.
It's also kind of integrated, though. I mean, it's different from, like, last week on our show, we also interviewed the people involved in a bike co-op called the 816 Bike Co-op and which fixes bikes and provides bikes to people who don't have them and recycles them and does all sorts of great things. But they're kind of individual. What you're talking about is more integrated, right?
Yes. There are a couple things about the Cleveland model that are different from the bike co-op you refer to, or many cooperatives around the country. First, the scale of them is a kind of industrial scale. I mean, we have commercial laundry facilities that are cleaning 25 to 30 million pounds of sheets and towels for the large hospitals in the area. So they're, you know, and that one company employs about 200 people. So there's a certain scale to it. The other thing is they're, as you said, they're quite integrated. So all of the companies are linked by the same philosophy and the same principles. All the companies contribute 10% of their profits to a fund that's used to start new companies. You know, how many corporations, you know, willingly give 10% of their profit so that other companies could be created so that more people could have work? That's a very different principle. One of the hallmarks is, as you know, we have a tremendous problem in this country of so many millions of people have been incarcerated, many for, you know, problems like smoking marijuana, which is legal in so many states, but lots of people are in jail. And they get out of jail, and they have that mark on their record, and it's virtually impossible for them to get work. But the Evergreen Cooperatives made a commitment that we're going to hire the people that have really been left out of the economy. So about 50% of the people we've hired are what we call returning citizens, people who've served their time and their debt to society and now need to get back into productive labor, and we hire folks like that.
Well, great. Let's talk about one other example you mentioned in the book. It's called Si Se Puede, and it's a co-op of immigrant house cleaners. And you say that they were able to raise their wages from $7 an hour to $20. Talk about the economics there that made that possible.
Well, you know, a lot of in that company of immigrant women, they're working in an industry that is very, very low paid. I mean, truly minimum wage. There's huge turnover because the work's so hard and people are making so little money. Of course, most of the people working in that industry are women. And it's really quite exploitative, you know, housekeeping, home care, all these kinds of things. And what the women in the company you're referring to did is say, well, let's band together. And instead of working for some corporation that has a division for house cleaning and, you know, we charge the customer $15 an hour, but, you know, we only get $7.50 of it and the rest goes to the company. Let's make this our very own company and own it ourselves and not have be paying outside people, but share in the profits ourselves. And so, yes, they've been able to raise their wages very significantly, far over the industry standard, because the money's staying in the company and staying in their pockets. Also, by the way, a lot of that house cleaning kind of work, housekeeping, often uses very, very bad chemicals for the people, mostly women, who are working in that industry, and this company made a commitment to use only green cleaning products, and therefore it's better for them and their health. So you get a number of different benefits. And again, this is, you know, not theory, and it's not pie in the sky. These are women who've come together, over 100 of them, and established this company that's very successful. And there are lots of examples of that all over the nation.
Let's get to some of the criticism parts of this. Your concept of the democratic economy, you oppose to what you call the extractive economy. You don't use the words socialism and capitalism so much in the book. You talk about the extractive economy and the democratic economy. What's your critique of the so-called extractive economy?
Well, you know, it's as the president of the United States is fond of saying, right? The stock market's never been higher, the gross domestic product's never been higher. You know, things are just churning along, and it's true. This system we live in, this form of hyper, you know, what I call some call casino capitalism, it is very productive at creating a huge amount of wealth. The problem is that it's all being It's not being left in our communities or left in the pockets of the people who really do the work, but it's being incredibly concentrated into the 0.01%. You know, just a few figures, and I'm sure you know them well. You know, three people in America own as much wealth as the bottom 160 million of us.
Mm-hmm.
Since the Great Recession and the financial collapse of a decade ago, 95% of all the income gains that have been made over the last 10 years have gone to 1% of the people. In the wealthiest economy in the history of the world, the biggest economy, 47% of Americans can't assemble $400 easily to meet an emergency. You know, their car breaks down or their daughter twists her ankle and has to go to the doctor and they don't have health insurance. So we live in a very productive economy, but most of us are being left behind. And not just the poor, the working class, the middle class is being hollowed out. And so it's no surprise, I think, that 71% of the American public, and these include Democratic voters and Trump voters, 71% say the economy is rigged against me and in favor of the wealthy. And so if we don't want ever more concentration, let alone the climate change implications of all of this, if we don't want more concentration, we need to find a way to what I would call democratize the economy, put more of the economy in the hands of the people who really are building it, and that's through cooperatives and through employee ownership and municipal ownership and land trusts and public banking, all these mechanisms that are inherently, in a sense, fairer and certainly produce better outcomes for communities.
So is this just a kind of reformed capitalism, or is it a different system? You quote Gar Alperovitz, who's actually one of my heroes, and you've dedicated the book to him. You quote him as saying, our work is to help people see here are the things that we can build now in the world, that point toward a different system. Are you moving toward a different system, or are you just trying to reform the current system?
Well, you know, to state it very bluntly, we are not trying to reform capitalism. We're not trying to make it, some people call it conscious capitalism or capitalism with a heart. We're not trying to do that. What we're saying is, just as, you know, there used to be feudalism and it was swept away as a system and something new arrived, or there used to be Pharaoh's Egypt and it was swept away. These things, these systemic changes happen over and over again in history. And our argument is, rather than try to reform this capitalist system, we need to build a new system based on different principles. So, you know, capitalism, and it has this way particularly, you mentioned neoliberalism at the beginning, since the 1980s, you know, the basic principle has been maximize shareholder value for the investors. Just keep the stock going up. Not what's the quality of the job, not, you know, lifting people out of poverty or strengthening their household assets. Just make it make more profits for the people who are investors. And we don't think that can be reformed. We think there needs to be a whole new sense of ownership in the country. And so we're trying to create a new system that's neither capitalism as we know it, and it's certainly not the sort of state socialism that we used to be familiar with the Soviet Union. So, yes, this is about fundamental system change, I believe.
Okay. Let me just remind your listeners, we're talking to Ted Howard, who with Marjorie Kelly is the author of a new book called The Making of a Democratic Economy, Building Prosperity for the Many, Not Just the Few. And it's published by, who's your publisher?
The publisher is called Barrett Kohler. And one of the reasons we went with them, they do a lot of sort of economics business books, but primarily we went with that publisher because it is an employee-owned company. All the people work in it own the company, so it's an expression of the spirit of the book.
Okay. I'm not going to have time to go through all the questions I actually have for you. Let me just say that you give a lot of examples of this growth of a democratic economy worldwide, and this is not just a phenomenon in the United States by any means. But let me put on my skeptic's hat for a minute.
You talk about how basically there's this kind of subversive effort to build within the shell of the old this new economy. Well, you know, capitalism is a very resilient system. It's also a system that can be extremely self-protective and vicious. So aren't we going to see a lot of blocking of this new economy through the use of state power, through union busting, through various tactics that corporations have used for years in order to keep the wealth to the owners?
Well, I think that's a very good point. You know, a country that is so strongly concentrated in its wealth among, you know, a handful of large, you know, corporate behemoths and wealthy individuals, you know, at the end of the day, this is about power. I mean, we could see how, you know, we can't get anything meaningful to happen on climate change because the big energy companies are standing in our way.
Right.
We can't get anything meaningful happening on drug prices because of the big pharmaceutical companies. You see what's happening in Washington, D.C. Our whole government's been captured by this crazy situation we have with concentrated wealth. So, yes, I think as the new economy that we're describing in the book is built, ultimately there is going to be some resistance to it. That's why things like local and state policy become very important so that we can start to build a new base of support locally. That's why political organizing in communities and in unions is very important. No system just says, well, you're right, we could do better, we'll get out of the way. But just because that is the concentrated powers may resist, that's not a reason not to proceed. We need to proceed or else we're really going to lose our country. And by the way, in addition to what you said, Judy, that, you know, there will be some resistance to this, obviously, and it could be quite extraordinary resistance. I think that one of the equally big impediment to achieving a democratic economy is, for most of us, we just think it's almost unimaginable. It's always going to be this way. How do you live in a society that's not dominated by the giant corporate power that we have now? People feel too small. They feel burned. They elect people for office, and then they're beholden to their, you know, the people that fund their campaigns. So I think we need to, as individuals, you and I and everybody listening, need to get our own ambition up and our own vision up and proceed forward and see ourselves as we're the architects of history. So let's go out and do the job that's ours to do.
And let me just say, Ted, that I find that part of your book quite inspiring. You talk about the need for a different kind of mindset. And I think we all can get very, very negative. And so this is a good antidote to that. And it's a good read. Thank you so much for being on the Heartland Labor Forum, Ted Howard.
Thank you.
This is Melvin Merritt saying get ready, Kansas City, for Penny Mills' 9th upcoming community boating excursion coming this December the 27th. Time 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Where? Diamond Boat in Independence. Ages 5 to 21 to all children. For more information, you can contact 816-204-0428. The website is pennymillinc.org. And this message is a public service of KKFI 90.1 FM.
Hello, this is Joseph Jackson. Join me on Cowtown Conversations, where we will discuss matters that impact your life as a resident of the Kansas City metropolitan area. Every Thursday morning at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
Follow that North Star. If there are no stars, just follow the river. Listen for them. Fear is your enemy.
Whoa. Easy now.
I'm gonna be free or die.
I don't know if you know how extraordinary this is, but you have made it 100 miles to freedom all by yourself. Would you like to pick a new name to mark your freedom?
Harriet Tubman. You are welcome here anytime. If I'm free, my family should be too. I made up my mind, I'm going back. You're confident, composed. When trouble comes, you'll be ready.
And that was a clip from the trailer of the movie Harriet. Good evening. My name is Christine Disming, and you are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight, we're going to be looking at the recent historical movie Harriet, the feature film that looks into the life and legacy of Harriet Tubman. On the show, we have with us Michael Savoir and Heather Schlazman. Good evening, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Good to be here.
Now, first of all, without giving away too much of the plot of the movie, can you tell our listeners, what was your overall thoughts on the film?
Well, I personally enjoyed the film. I thought it was well done. It was historically accurate. It certainly, there is a need to kind of make or bring to mind the horrors of the institution of slavery to our general public. So I thought it was well.
I'd agree with everything. And also, I really found the movie very inspirational. I really love the idea of a strong minority woman being in such a heroic role, showing such courage and saving so many people.
Could you guys, just thinking back to the film, was there a moment that stuck out with you or a moment that really spoke to you that had a lasting impact on your thoughts on the film?
Well, certainly you talked about her courage and her faith. Certainly I thought was an interesting aspect because she truly believed that failure for her was not possible. And as a result of that, as I understood the historical aspect, she made over 20 trips back to the South to bring folks back up into Pennsylvania. So, I was impressed with that, you know.
Heather?
You know, there are a lot of parts of the movie that I found very moving and very inspirational. I think there were two different parts that really stayed with me. The first was the part that was reflected in the trailer that we just listened to when she completes her first journey to freedom and she realizes she's free for the first time. And then the second part was when she went back to see her mother and the reunion with her mother. As the mother of a daughter myself, and of course as a daughter, and I'm very close to my mother, I found the reunion between mother and daughter incredibly moving. And again, it comes back to this theme of courage, just raw courage that she showed in getting out and then going back to rescue others.
And one thing I think personally for me, a moment that stood out for it, well, more of, it wasn't just a moment, it was something that I personally learned when I was watching the film, is growing up in K-12 education, I learned about Harriet Tubman. I learned about her courage and what she did, maybe not the full story, but there's someone else in the movie, William Still, the abolitionist. Learning about him, we learned about many different abolitionists throughout that time period, many of them white males. However, learning about him and his role and what big, it made me want to do further and deeper research, what other questions I had about. So I'm going to bring it to you guys. Was there any questions or maybe thoughts, thought-provoking ideas that this film brought out in you, either questions or maybe even critiques that you had about it?
Well, one thing is with absolute assurance, and it's the humorous side, if there was a 100-mile foot race to be run, why? Harriet would be the undisputed champion. She certainly did a lot of running, and indeed. But no, I don't think I can point out any single thing that sticks out for me.
I think one of the things that really stuck out for me, and it was sort of a question I had about what the screenwriter was really trying to accomplish, was the idea that there were black slave catchers. I understand from just doing some of my own research and talking to people that wasn't historically accurate, which, and I remember thinking when I saw the movie, wondering whether it was historically accurate that there were black slave catchers. And I don't know what that added to the script. Why would the screenwriter have added that? What point was the screenwriter trying to make?
And one of my other questions, what drove you to see the film? What was something that I caught, which is just enjoy going to see historical films? What opportunities did you guys have to go see it? Or is it something that either it looked like to be an educational film? Basically, what drove you to go see Harriet?
Well, certainly for me, it was the overall lack of accurate historical analysis that that we as a culture have had. You know, I didn't get any history of slavery when I went to school. And it was only during my college years, if I had the initiative to do some black history, in a sense, that and I think all the world needs to know, quite honestly.
I went to it as a part of a community event that was co-sponsored by the Heartland Center for Jobs and Freedom and the Fight for Stand Up KC and the Fight for 15. It was a really well-attended event at the Glenwood Theater in Overland Park. And I went to it as part of that, although I'd seen the movie advertised and was interested in it just from the standpoint, you know, again, of a historical movie, but also a historical where there's a woman heroine.
And my wrap-up question for both of you is, with this film now coming out, is there any other topics around this time period that you feel like should be explored in film? Is there another, because this is our first and hopefully of many feature-length film, I mean, put into theaters about Harriet Tubman. Is there any other topics that you want explored from this time period?
Well, you know, there were so many worthy individuals during the slavery, the heroic acts, the unspeakable acts, and so much of our history, not just for black people, but for all people, are void of the details of this period. You know, and I think we'd be a stronger culture if we were more mindful, you know, collectively of these historical events.
Mm-hmm. And I would second that, and I think to go back to a point that you made earlier, I think there's a lot of stories that still need to be told about this era. I think your point about the abolitionist, who we met briefly in the movie, but we don't know much about him. And I think he probably has a really fascinating story to tell, and I think there are a lot of stories like that. There's a lot more about this history that needs to be told.
Thank you. And now for our listeners who may not have been around social media for a bit, there's some controversy surrounding this film in the terms of the historical accuracy and its general production. On the phone, we have Professor of History at Penn Valley Community College, Albert Lowe, to give us his perspective on the film. Albert, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, could you tell us a little bit of your take on the historical inaccuracies in the movie Harriet?
So the movie Harriet was definitely a movie that needed to be done. Unfortunately, as far as the historical, well, I'll say this, the historical perspective was, or the historical accuracy was right around 80 to 85%. So it was, the historical accuracy was still there. I think that the film, though, pulled its punches. Like one of the speakers said earlier, about the black antagonist. I think that was a part in there that really didn't exist and shouldn't have been, it wasn't necessary.
Why do you think the directors made that choice? I've seen different choices they made of who they chose and why they want to tell the story, but that was actually a question that came up with me in my head as well as I watched this film. Why do you think they went that direction to have a black antagonist that wasn't necessarily historically accurate?
Yeah, you know, I was speaking with a couple of my colleagues about that same issue, and we couldn't wrap our heads around it either. I personally had, I don't take issue with it. I just look at the film as being slightly diluted when discussing the horrors of slavery, as opposed to a more graphic film like 12 Years a Slave.
So you feel like it was more of a watered-down version that...
Right. Okay. So I like to use analogies because, like this, for example, I like hot sauce. So I'll use the analogy of hot sauce. If all of the movies documenting slavery, like the like Roots, like 12 Years a Slave, if they were all hot sauce, Harriet would be sweet chili. and the reason why I say that is because when it comes to the horrors of slavery, why a person would want to risk their lives to run 100 miles and possibly risk getting caught, possibly risk getting separated from their family, possibly risk getting limbs amputated. Why would they risk that? The film didn't show too much of the reason why people were leaving, even to the point to where there's a part in the movie, and I'm not going to give everything out, where a person tries not to go. So, well, I don't know if I really want to go. Well, you know, for me, even a person who knows about slavery, I could understand and sympathize, well, I don't really want to make this trip because things could be good here. So I think that the horrors should have been shown, me personally, because what that does is it allows the audience to be drawn into this institution that was so inhumane.
And that is a criticism that I've heard from absolutely more than one person. I've read articles on it as well. And you mentioned 12 Years a Slave. I did catch the other film. What other films do you feel like do a better job at depicting the absolute horrors and atrocities around slavery in the United States?
Well, remember that Roots was historic mm-hmm. in nature because that was the first time that the institution of slavery and its horrors were actually projected onto the screen. So that was definitely significant. But I show 12 Years a Slave in my classes, in my United States history classes before the Civil War, to show them that this is the most accurate depiction of American slavery ever done. And the thing about that film is that it took English people to do it. Steve McQueen was English. So even Americans didn't want to get that, you know. So that's the... You know, that's one of the movies that I would highly suggest, 12 Years a Slave. But it is graphic. It touches your soul.
Yeah, and from what I'm gathering, so you probably would not show the movie Harriet to your students, which you teach at a college, you have a much more mature audience. Would you suggest it for maybe a younger audience, such as elementary or middle school audience? For them to see,
oh, yeah.
Harriet?
Absolutely, 100%, because it takes out the graphic events. Mm-hmm. Like, and I mean, I guess that's where I have a little issue with it. For example, we understand slightly, we barely get into why this woman was having fainting spells, but nobody actually really discusses or like shows that she got hit in the head with a brick. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, it was a weight. She got hit in the head with a 8-pound weight, which fractured her skull. That's why she was having fainting attacks. So I think that type of information could have been very valuable for the person who doesn't know a lot about Harriet Tubman. And there's another part in there where, I don't want to say that, because I don't want to give away the movie.
Oh, absolutely. And it's still out there in film, so people can still see it. But it has, so for some audiences, it'll be wonderful. So younger audiences, that first introducing them and educating them about the horrors of slavery before they're built up to see. So, and I personally teach middle school, so I could show my middle school students this. And by the time they get to high school, by the time they get to college, they have a foundational knowledge to understand the larger atrocities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there was a part of the movie that really didn't set well with me, is if the abolitionists kind of knew that the Civil War was coming, which no one knew that the Civil War was coming. So that kind of, you know, and then I'm not going to tell the part, but they started to lead up to as if everyone knew that the war was going to happen, which was completely inaccurate.
Do you feel like for this film, maybe to be a little more successful, do you think they should have broadened the story to encompass even more people and having Harriet Tubman as one small part? Or do you think they should have done something like what they did with Selma, focus more on a very specific point of time and dive very deep into it? What's your opinion on that?
Well, I personally think that the movie Harriet was really good. I mean, focusing in on Harriet Tubman was a really good movie. The idea is great. I don't take anything away from that. I'm just saying that as far as the historical accuracy is when it comes to an antagonist, I think that they went a little bit far with that one, and some of the punches were pulled. That's the only issue I have. I think that movie was really good. And there was a question posed to one of the other speakers about movies that should be done. There's a guy named Robert Smalls. Robert Smalls escaped from slavery using a Confederate ship and outwitted the Confederates and barely made it to the Union side with his family, dressed up, disguised as a Confederate. That's a movie that, that needs to be told. Sorry, I just wanted to throw that out there.
No. That's I love history. I mean, I teach social studies, so any new information I learn, I just want to take it in. And even I've never heard of that before. I feel like that definitely should be a film to make, because I feel like that's a story that needs to be told. There's, I mean, many stories, just like our guests here were saying, that need to be told. Wow, that's something. And what's his name again?
His name is Robert Smalls.
Robert
Smalls. He ends up being one of the elected officials during Reconstruction. It, along with my great 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 uncle, Blanche Shelfo Bruce.
Oh wow! That learn something new every day.
Yeah. That's where my love for history comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're getting into the last couple of minutes. I actually have two more questions for you. The first one, and since we have time for this, one of the critiques from their films that I've been seeing is the lead actress that's playing Harriet, Cynthia Erivo, that some people wanted someone who's ADOS, American descent of slavery, to play Harriet, but she's British with Nigerian parents. What's your thoughts on that? Should they pick someone who... was American descendant of slavery, or do you think it was all right with them picking Cynthia to play the role of Harriet?
Personally, I think that who they cast could have been, I think that looking at that is slightly trivial, because slavery was something that would have affected her family had she been here as well. So I personally don't see anything wrong with the actress. I think she did a really good job
mm-hmm.
on the film. But, yeah, I mean, I don't think that anything was missing because she wasn't a Black American descendant of slavery.
Okay. That was something that had been bringing up in a large part of the conversation. I thought, I understand people's perspective on it completely, but I still mm-hmm. think she did a wonderful job acting. I mean, she... definitely deserves an award for it, because I'm pretty impressed with her. And
right.
Now I'm coming to my last question. What do you think that we can learn from this film? What can we today take away from the movie Harriet? What can we learn for our listeners who have already seen it, or they're curious about going and seeing it? What can we learn from it?
I think that what we can learn is the woman, Harriet Tubman, is a special type of person that usually comes around once a generation. She was able to maneuver through the South without knowing how to read and write. That is marvelous, because it's difficult in this world right now without slavery to operate without knowing how to read and write. So I think that this story was one that should have been told a long time ago. It's unfortunate that it wasn't. But this one was definitely important, because it shows not just the woman, but her acts. I just wish it would have gotten a little bit more in detailed, but that's okay. That's where people like myself come in to provide the details to the people who are watching.
Absolutely.
But I think that the movie is absolutely significant.
Yeah, well, you know what? We're just wrapping up right now. Thank you so much, Albert Lowe. Thank you for coming on the show and giving us more of your insights. And for our listeners, thank you for staying tuned to listen about Harriet. And also, once again, thank you for Heather and Michael for being on air. Thank you so much, and for listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, and have a good night.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel, and it's time for Washington Window on Workers. And with us by phone from Washington is Mark Grunberg from PAI News Service, which brings us a lot of our labor news. Hi, Mark. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays, everybody.
So you've been doing an incredibly detailed year-end roundup of what's going on for labor in the last year. I have to say it's not a very rosy picture.
Definitely not.
Yeah. But one of the things I wanted to focus on is not impeachment, because I think we've had up to here with that right now. But, you know, the House passed a bunch of pro-labor bills, and they didn't go anywhere because the Senate hasn't considered them. Talk about what you think the most significant ones were.
I think there are several that are really significant. One that jumps out is raising the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour.
Yeah.
The federal minimum wage hasn't gone up for a decade now. Something like 29 states plus D.C., not to mention the city of Kansas City and the city of St. Louis, have gone ahead and said, the hell with you, we're raising our own minimum wages. Of course, then Missouri repealed Kansas City, Missouri's ordinance raising the minimum wage. And that would have helped millions upon millions of workers, not just the lowest income workers, mm-hmm. but the ones right above them, because when somebody who's at the bottom of the scale goes up, the boss has to basically bump up the people above him or her. It's usually a her. And so as a result, the old rising tide lifts all boats, but Mitch McConnell pulled the plug on or drilled a hole in the bottom of the boat. As a result, that bill's not going anywhere, among others.
Okay.
Calls it socialism.
The PRO Act was another one. Did that pass the House yet?
It hasn't passed the House yet. It has passed the House Education and Labor Committee, and it's waiting action on the floor.
And that's a really, really important one.
Legislation passed the House. Equal pay for equal work passed the House. Lots of other, you know, specific pro-worker things passed the House, and they're all buried in the Senate.
Right, right. And then, of course, there was the colossal budget bill, which was just enacted. And last week I reported on one of the positive things about that, because there were a lot of negatives in there, like the border wall. But there was a positive for bailing out the mine workers' pension fund. Were there any other good things in that bill?
There were. For one thing, federal workers will get a pay raise. President Trump originally wanted to give them zero, but instead they're all going to get a 3.1% increase, and for high-cost areas, places like Chicago and New York and San Francisco, there's going to be an extra slight bump. There's going to be some protections restored to at least Defense Department workers. Now, the rest of the civilian workforce is another matter. One thing that wasn't in the budget bill was basically rolling back Trump's executive orders that would strip workers and unions a lot of their protections.
Right, didn't federal workers get paid family leave?
Yes, and that was in the DOD bill also.
Yeah,
it's not paid family leave. It is only paid parental leave.
So, in other words,
only if you have a new baby, you can take the leave. If you have a sick grandmother, you can't.
Okay, or if you're sick yourself, I suppose. Yeah. Okay, anything else you think was really significant in 2019 that we need to mention?
I think the most significant thing was that people got out on the streets and stayed there. People realized that you got to go around these roadblocks in Washington, D.C., and so you had the GM workers being forced to strike and winning, mm-hmm. winning back some of the concessions they made after the crash 10 years ago. You had the Chicago teachers and paraprofessionals forced to strike, not over pay, but over things like class size, mental health aides, librarians, nurses, and they got that. You had the L.A. teachers who were forced to strike over many of the same things, plus trying to ban the quote-unquote charter schools, which are really a right-wing scheme to defund public education, and so on.
That was a big development.
People out in the streets.
Well, and also I noticed that in statistics, we had more strikes in 2019 than we've had in many years. So maybe that will continue into 2020. So Happy New Year. Thank you so much, Mark Grunberg, and we'll talk to you in January.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye. And we have a very short calendar again. It seems like there aren't too many labor events occurring over the holidays. What a surprise. So you can get ready for the Martin Luther King celebrations that will be coming in mid-January. There's the, I like this one, the 16th Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Bowling Celebration, hosted by United Auto Workers Local 249 and 31 Civil Rights Committees, which is going to be Sunday, January 19th, the eve of the Martin Luther King birthday holiday, from 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. at AMF Pro Bowl at 505 East 18th Avenue in North Kansas City. And then there's the annual Southern Christian Leadership Council, MLK, Community Forum and Mass Celebration, which will be on January 20th, Martin Luther King Day. The time is yet to be announced, and that will be at the Palestine Missionary Baptist Church. You can find our calendar, as well as our archived shows and our upcoming schedule, on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. And we will, our next week's show is to be announced. We're actually scheduling this weekend for January, February. And I want to thank our engineer all year, Jen Zaman. And I hope that she continues in the next year. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.